Chapter 70. As planned, Kurt swam after the submersible. But even with the power assist from the suit, he was losing the race. The ungainly sub was still faster than the fastest swimmer. It pulled away on a direct line to the Monarch. Kurt realized he could never catch it. He turned and swam the other way, heading for one of the powerboats still bobbing on the swells above the Minerve. He reached it, found it empty, and climbed in. By the time he started the engine, the submersible had reached the Monarch. He saw the crewmen gather around, pull the canister free, and discard the submersible as if it was nothing. They didn't bother trying to haul the sub aboard. They hadn't sent any help for the injured divers, and they'd abandoned Volk at the bottom of the sea. They were about to hightail it out of there. Kurt gunned the engine and turned the wheel. His last chance to stop the Monarch and grab the canister was fading fast. Tessa watched as Woods brought the canister on board. "Is that it?" "Looks like the one we found on the Dakar," Woods said. Tessa used a crowbar to knock the accumulated salts and rust from the latches. "Open it," she ordered. Woods dropped down and pried the canister open, revealing two smaller, hermetically sealed containers. They were untouched by corrosion. "The seals are good," he announced. "The cultures should be intact." "Great work," Tessa said. She immediately contacted the pilots. "Power up. Get us into takeoff position." Woods looked out the back. "What about the rest of the men?" "We don't have time to wait," she said. "Austin may have called for help. We don't want to be here if any arrives." Woods hesitated for a second and then nodded. "So long, Volk. Looks like you're the one being left behind." Tessa thought about rescuing Volk, but even that effort would have been too time-consuming. "Secure the canister," she ordered. "I'm going to the cockpit." She rushed forward and up the ladder, never looking down. Had she even glanced below, she would have seen a figure emerging from the hatch that led to the maintenance tunnel beneath the bottom deck. She might even have recognized him as one of her former captives. Joe had already opened the hatch when he heard Tessa running his way. Pulling it down, he waited for her to pass by and go up the ladder. He could feel the plane moving and picking up speed and had no desire to be on it when it tried to get airborne again. Glancing along the bottom deck, he was surprised to see it completely empty. No cars, no boats, no submersibles, just a vast, cavernous space and the bearded man named Woods working to secure a metal cylinder. Joe stepped onto the deck, began moving aft, and then rushed at Woods. Woods looked up from the cylinder at the last moment just as Joe swung his leg. The blow caught Woods on the side of the face and sent him tumbling. Before the big man could get to his feet, Joe dropped down on him and threw a knockout punch. "That's for Priya." The punch left Woods unconscious and sprawled on the deck. Now he needed to get off the plane. Joe rushed to the back of the aircraft, rolling the container along with him. It banged against the upraised tail ramp and stopped. Joe didn't bother with the regular controls. He went right for the emergency release, pulled it down, and watched the ramp fall. This time it hit with the splash he'd been expecting before. It locked into place, creating an instant wake and pulling water back up onto itself in two swirling eddies. Kurt had the speedboat running flat out, but with the Monarch's engines spooling up to full thrust, he couldn't close in. He ducked behind the tail to avoid the jet blast and bring the boat up onto the Monarch's wake. With the smooth wake of the aircraft to travel on and the suction effect caused by the Monarch's forward progress, Kurt picked up more speed, drafting the big plane and nearing the tail. Now he needed some way to stop the plane. Looking around, he spotted one of the grenade-tipped spear guns. He reached down, grabbed it, and brought it up to his shoulder. He was about to fire when the tail ramp dropped and a long-lost friend appeared. Dropping the spear gun, Kurt nursed every last ounce of speed from the boat, closed in on the ramp, and bumped up onto it. Joe shouted to him, "And they say there's never a cab when you need one." "Get in," Kurt shouted back. "This ride's on me." Joe heaved the banded cylinder in the boat. "Have a feeling people might be looking for this." "Only for the last 50 years. Joe gave the boat a shove and jumped in the moment it began to move. As soon as they reached the water, Kurt turned away from the plane. "It's too bad she's going to get away," Kurt said, "but we have what we need."
"I don't think she's going very far," Joe said.
Sitting in the cockpit, Tessa shouted at the pilots, who were slowing the plane after a warning light alerted them to the tail ramp's position. "Override the emergency release," she said. "Raise the aft door and get us out of here." The co-pilot did as ordered, while the captain put the thrust levers back to full. The plane accelerated, but only to a point. 50 knots, the pilot said. "Activate cavitation." The correct switches were thrown, but the high-pressure air bleeding off the engines never reached the lower part of the hull. "We have multiple failures on the high-pressure air system," the co-pilot said. "Low-pressure lines failing also." As Tessa struggled to believe what was happening, a transmission came over the radio. In a reversal of the incident in Bermuda, Austin was talking to her on a captured transmitter. "It's over, Tessa," Kurt said. "We have military aircraft inbound, and you'll never get off the water." The captain confirmed the last statement. "We can't take off without the cavitation system. The drag is too high." "You might as well stand down," Austin said. His voice infuriated her. "Full power," she demanded. "Turn into the swells. As we begin to pitch, we'll break free of the water." "But Tessa, do as I say." The pilots followed her commands, and the Monarch turned slightly and began to accelerate once again. As it picked up speed, the plane rose and fell. It began to bounce across the swells, skipping and grasping at the air. Each new wave bumped them higher. Each return to the sea brought a more painful impact than the last. "The vibration is too much," the captain said. "The airframe is going to buckle." "I built this plane," Tessa shouted. "I know what it's capable of." The pilot shook his head and went to retard the throttles, but Tessa reached forward and leaned on them, keeping the power at full. The aircraft leapt again. 70 knots. 80. With each jump, the plane picked up more speed and remained airborne a little longer. "One more bounce," she thought. "One more leap." The next impact was sudden and jarring, with the nose crashing through the top of the wave and the wing pylon bending. The pylon twisted and tore free. The plane tilted to the right. The wingtip hit the sea, and the entire structure buckled as it was torn away. The Monarch slewed to the side, traveling at 100 knots and billowing fuel from its ruptured tanks. The heat of the engines ignited the cloud of vapor, causing a chain reaction of explosions that blew the plane apart. Kurt and Joe watched the failed takeoff from well behind the aircraft. Reaching the crash zone, they found only wreckage, floating debris, and a swath of burning kerosene that stretched for several hundred feet. They circled the inferno several times, but upon finding no survivors, they returned to the waters above the Minerve to pick up their own people. Rudy came aboard first, with Gamay next, and once he'd exited the ADS suit, Paul. The injured divers on the surface were kept at arm's length, while the two divers trapped in the submarine below were released and allowed to surface. They were also forced to remain in the water until help arrived in the form of 3 Marine helicopters dispatched from Sicily. With 2 dozen Marines deployed in several inflatable boats and the helicopters circling, the situation was well in hand. Kurt and a pair of Marine divers swam down and released Volk from his half-buried submersible and brought him to the surface. He and the other survivors from Tessa's crew were placed into custody and taken to a military base on Sicily. The Numa crew flew to Malta, where a Gulfstream aircraft waited to take Rudy, the Trouts, and the bacterial cultures of the counteragent back to the United States. Kurt and Joe had one more task to accomplish before they could rest. They took a different aircraft and flew eastward, landing at the abandoned airbase in Kazakhstan and searching for Priya. Joe found the section of the base where the Monarch had been parked, and from there made his way to the helicopter that he and Priya had been hiding in. He stepped inside. The Mercedes was there, still parked in the back, but there was no sign of Priya.
He walked through to the cockpit, where Priya was sleeping in one of the pilot's chairs. Joe touched her face, and Priya woke up. She was disoriented and looked at him as if she might be dreaming. Joe? Her voice was hoarse, her lips cracked, and her face dirty. But at least she was alive.
Are you really here?
She asked. I am, Joe said. He leaned down, scooped her up, and carried her out through the back of the helicopter. And I've come to take you home.